not purposely sort of accidental, but the custom speech speaker. And he had three possible titles, and this was one of the key ones.
Thanks. I guess I should thank Chris for roping me into doing this talk. And so when I first agreed to do this, part of the reason was that I've been reading a couple of interesting things from maybe 30 or 40 years ago that I think are fairly clear. Part of the reason was to see what other people think of these axiomatic systems, which I think are fairly clear and suggest interesting ways to modify the structure of quantum theory, which is part of the title, The Wiggling. It's also referenced, which I'll get to later. So most of what I do every day is basically stare at Hilbert space. And the reason I do that is to try and understand its mathematical structure. So where all the various objects, that we usually use in quantum theory, how they relate to each other, and more than that, also where they come from. So is there some kind of physical basis for these objects, either operational or maybe interpretational? There's lots of ways you could look at this question. And the main reason is actually to try and derive it from some possibly simpler and more physical postulates than what we have so far. So the idea is that this exercise of trying to derive it will tell you something about the structure of the theory, the mathematical structure, its origin, and so forth. And it might also give you insight into going beyond it, which is sort of the main focus of my talk. And it also, if this kind of thing keeps you up at night, it might help you sleep better. So I guess I already mentioned, we have all these various objects, an algebra of observables. So we have these operators which are associated to measurement outcomes, and there's a product between them. They have some very special properties. The question is, where does that come from? What could be the physical basis for that, if there's any? Then there's things like unitary evolution. There's symmetric transition probabilities, by which I mean you have objects like this. So as you'll hopefully see, this is actually a pretty special property when looked at from a more general point of view. This fact that if you take a state and then you have another state which is in a sense associated with a measurement, you can reverse these two. So if that's not clear right now, hopefully it will be later on. Another special property is set of properties are the projection operators and the way we update states after measurement. And you'll see what I mean by that soon too. So I'm just going to go over, I think what's most people here probably know this structure, but I'm just going to go through it really quickly. And then I'm going to go through one particular axiomatic system that sort of brings out these features. And then I'll just do two quick examples of theories that don't satisfy these axioms. And then just a couple of vague comments and questions at the very end about what these kinds of things suggest. So the idea of a reconstruction or a derivation is that you want to reconstruct or derive the mathematical structures in the theory, the theorems and the main results, from some mathematical postulates, which are representations of some physical postulates. So you start out with some hopefully physical postulates, something that has clear operational meaning, like in special relativity, the speed of light is independent of source. Then you represent that in some mathematical framework, and then you hopefully derive the rest of the theory. You have to be a bit careful, though, with the status of your postulates and whether you think of them as sort of logically necessary or necessary for doing science, or that they represent some deep phenomenological principle about the world. You shouldn't take them as final. And I'm going to argue that one important criterion for a set of axioms is the fact that they should suggest generalizations or modifications. Instead of just reconstructing the theory, this should be an extra nice feature that you hopefully have. So there have been a lot of approaches to doing this in the past, starting around I guess the 50s and 60s with von Neumann, who started a lot of these different approaches. So they fall roughly into three categories, which are the logical or quantum logic approach, which studies the relationship between different experimental propositions, and usually the axioms are very mathematical in this approach. You postulate some lattices of propositions, and then these have special properties. And it's some axiomatic systems are more physical, but a lot of them are just very, very focused on the structure. The other main approach is the algebras of observables approach, which led into the C-star algebras framework. And the main focus here is the algebra of observables. So you have a product between observables, which is actually a very special property. So the question is, why should your measurement outcomes have a product? What does that mean operationally? Right. So this kind of approach already assumes that you have that structure. And you also have sums of observables and things like this. So it's already very restrictive. But a more general approach, which I think in some sense maybe subsumes the previous two, because there are a lot of the structures in this approach, a lot of the structures in the previous two approaches can be seen as special features of this more general approach, the convexity approach, which I'm going to go through very briefly. So these are the older attempts at derivation. More recently, because of the advent of quantum information theory, people have been more interested in information directed access. So there's been a lot of recent work on this, in which people take things like information processing tasks or conditions, conditions on optimal reasoning, so a motivation point of view, and what your physical theory is and what it tells you, things like continuity of certain things in the theory, composite and subsystem conditions, things like this. And one thing that's come out of this is that if you look at quantum theory from this more broad point of view, a lot of the seemingly quantum features are generic. So I'm not going to dwell on that. If you have questions, you can ask me. So any questions on you so far? So the starting point of this approach is to take a physical theory and look at it from the broadest possible view, where you sort of forget all the details, Hamiltonians and fields and things like this. You ask what are the essential features that any given physical theory should have. And what you get are that physical theory should at very least predict measurement outcomes and correlating experiences. But it should also, in some sense, simplify or compress these correlations. So you don't just want a giant lookup table of you do an experiment and then what happens, right? So that's going to come up in the next couple slides. So you take this point.
What was the bottom?
So what's
what are the essential features? Look at it from a distance.
What
is, you didn't explain that point.
So that's what I'm going to go through. What are the essential features? Maybe I'll come there. So this is sort of, these are the essential features, right? This is what's left. If you sort of abstract away.
Are you saying no, Hamiltonians are not essential features?
Yeah.
That was the
point. Particular Hamiltonians, particular assumptions about particular fields, things like this.
Okay.
These aren't essential.
Got it.
So this is what's essential. So this is a very common and idealized formalization of what goes on in the lab, right? So you have some list of instructions for how to prepare some physical system, for how to build some apparatus, and hook it up to other apparatuses and things like this. And that's represented by these preparations as I. So they're just boxes with buttons and outcomes and things like this at the most abstract level. And then the preparation presumably takes in some system and it does something to it and spits it out. And the system goes into a measurement / transformation device. So usually when people present these formalisms, they think of the transformation as separate, sort of in between the preparation and measurement. But for what I'm going to do later, it's more intuitive and clear to do it this way, because I'm going to focus on particular measurements which are also transformations, right? So the filters sort of scale it.
Can you just conceptualize everything away and just have the one box, which is also the preparation box as well?
What do you mean?
I mean, if that second box were just the same as the first box. I mean, sorry, if the first box was the same, what I'm trying to say is you just need the second box.
Oh, okay.
It can be a preparation device.
But you need a couple different stages, right? It's,
I guess it
comes better up there. You basically have one type of box, I guess. So the idea is that with each outcome, which is some light going on this apparatus, for example, that you associate a transformation of the system as well. Right? Which can also be thought of as preparation, right? The system is transforming into the spirit. So that's the side of that one box. So the idea is to take all these preparation procedures, all these list of instructions and boxes that you might have in some giant warehouse, put them together, and build a giant probability table. So this was sort of developed by Luca Manna, those are the references, but I think it's sort of the cleanest and most intuitive way to develop the structure. So the idea is you take some particular preparation, and then you take all the measurements that you have available to you, and you find the probabilities for this one particular preparation. So that would be a one call, right? And you take another preparation, you do this over and over and over. And say you have some finite list, right? You stop somewhere, you don't go forever. What this gives you is basically a matrix, right? The list of all those probabilities is a matrix. And using some linear algebra tricks, you can compress this giant matrix into a form like this. So given a coordinate in this matrix, which is the coordinate represents a particular preparation and a particular measurement inside J, you can find the probability of this outcome given this preparation in terms of an inner product between two vectors, right? Where the vectors are in a real vector space of dimension k, where k ends up being the rank of this matrix. So we call these vectors Si, the elements of the state space S. And the Ri, Rj, are elements of an effect in the space. And the idea is that these vectors are, in some sense, coordinates for these propositions, these list of instructions, and preparation boxes. Right. You can get more details in the reference. I don't want to dwell on this too much. It's just sort of an intuitive motivation for it. There are lots of other starting points, but they all end up essentially in the same place, which is going to be the next slide. So the idea so far is that you've taken a set of vectors, these states and these effects, which encode the content of this table, sort of the physics of this system. And the statistics of anything, quantum, classical, any physical theory can represent in this way. And for example, the rank of this matrix and the shape of this set of vectors tells you a lot about the properties of your theory, the qualitative and the quantitative properties, as hopefully you'll see.
Can I ask something?
Yeah.
Is it really true that any theory can be thought of that way? I mean, aren't you assuming that you can have any outcome, you know, in any particular case? I'm just thinking, you know, you need to have an entry in each of those spots, right?
Yeah.
But it could be zero, so...
Yeah, it could be zero. You could actually... I guess what you're thinking of may be some preparations for which you can't do measurement or some combinations
yeah.
are defined.
Yeah, I mean, you can have... I mean, obviously not quantum mechanics, but you have some sort of exotic theory.
In which?
Some sort of, you know, super selection rules or things that limit what you can...
Okay, so pair or... Maybe that's skipping ahead. I'm going to talk a bit about that, I think, later on.
Okay, well then...
So limits on what you can do in the lab, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but I guess then my question related to that is it really true that any physical theory can put in this form? Or is it any with some caveats later?
Why don't say any theory couldn't be expressed that way?
I'm not sure. So what kind of caveats would there be? So
I don't know. I'm just asking whether that's a, you know, whether that's a rigorous, you know,
no, there's
we've
no,
shown that this
no,
any physical theory. You know, like we start with these postulates on what a physical theory is, and therefore we know it can be put in this form.
Right.
Or if someone could come up with some convoluted, screwed-up physical theory that
or
satisfies some axioms, but it doesn't.
Or, for instance, one is not accustomed to talking about probabilities in the context of general relativity.
Right.
So you say, well, there are no probabilities. Where are you going to get your probability table from, boy?
Right. Well, we don't want to get it pretty 1 or 0, right? So in a theory like general relativity, maybe the preparations are some... So. The way I describe it is you have some box preparing the system. That doesn't have to be something you have in the lab. The preparation procedure could be prepare some black hole of a certain mass, a certain angular momentum. That's the preparation, right? So the table may be incomplete in some sense, right?
I mean, another problem is that the idea of preparation and measurement kind of assumes a sort of background time. At least the notion of time makes sense.
Right.
Which is probably not going to hold in quantum gravity.
That's true.
And is a bad notion in general relativity.
Yeah, yeah. There's ways to generalize it, I guess. So,
okay,
short
so
answer is not every theory can be.
Sorry?
Short answer, I guess, no, not every theory can be written in this particular way, but you can generalize it.
But it's pretty good for things that, you know, admit an operational description.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
a bit more generally. So we have this, we've got these vectors. The structure of these sets is very special. So you have a mistake space, and it ends up being a cone. So a cone is a convex set, which is also closed under multiplication by positive reals. Right? So the standard, I mean, it's pretty intuitive, right? So this is a cone where it just keeps going. So this is, you can think of this as S, big S, a set of all states. And the set of normalized states are live in a particular plane in this space, right? So these guys here, this particular plane. And then you can think of these outcomes or effects as positive linear functionals on these states, right? So you have this in the product. And then you can take, once you have, you can, so once you've sort of motivated structure, you can just postulate. So take any convex cone like this, and that's just like states. That will hopefully correspond to some strange theory, right? Something you can do in the lab. And then you can, once you have a set of states, you can take your measurements to just be any functionals on this space. Right? There may be actually extra restrictions that some of them may not be physical, but in this step, we can just take all of them. Right? It's just simpler to develop. And so there's a requirement that R of X is between 0 and 1, right? It's a probability. And there's a special functional which represents the proposition is the system there, right? So it tells you that you have a normalized state, right? There's a special functional that tells you whether you're in this plane or not. That's called U, or the Euler unit. And then the transformations for the dynamics are represented by just linear maps on the state space. And then, so I have this U of OS here. What this means is, that you take some initial states of preparation, you transform it in some way, and you figure out the probability of that happening, right? So these can be, these O's can be associated to particular events. So these can be conditional on some outcome. And this would be the probability of this outcome. Right? So this would be probability of, for example, RI. That's so cool. Okay. I'm probably spending too much time on this. So this is just sort of the picture I just drew, right? One feature that's going to be important later is these pure states, the faces of these cones. And the pure states you can think of as just preparations that can be simulated by convex combinations of other preparations. Okay. And zero state just means you have no system. Okay, so measurement outcomes as planes. There's a really way to think of the effects as planes like this. So for each effect, you essentially have two planes in the state space. So I'm looking at the normalized states, this plane of states, for example, and take all states for which this measurement assigns probability 1, 2, right? So that's all of these guys here. And then do the same thing for zero, and that's these guys here. Right? So the measurement is associated with these two planes, but it also determines two faces of your state space.
What are R and S again?
R are the effects, the measurement outcomes, the vectors representing them, and S are the preparations and states.
Okay, and that's R dot S.
Yeah. I couldn't get the equations for it, because a lot of the equations are there. Okay, so that sort of brings us to the most important thing for the axiomatic system later on, is this association between effects, transformations or operations, and preparations. And the idea is that you have this special class of operations which have these properties, which are the, in quantum case, they correspond to the projectors. But this concept is more general. It may not have some of the nice features that projectors have in the quantum case, as we'll see later, but it's still a really important part of these theories. So the idea is that you have a transformation device, which is linear, and it doesn't increase the trace of the system, the normalization constant. And if it doesn't decrease the normalization, then it leaves the system alone. So if it's transparent, it's neutral. So you can think of this as if you prepare a vertical polarized light, and you take a vertical polarization filter. This is an example of this. And it has this idempotence property, which can be motivated in different ways, but let's just take it. So the idea is that you have a measurement which its outcomes are represented by these RI vectors, and for each of these, there may be many OI, many transformations associated with it. And so I think I mentioned this before, but these filters determine the basis of your state space. So, yeah, an example there. Then maybe we'll make this a bit clearer. Okay, so one thing I want to argue in this talk is that these the geometry of these spaces, so a lot of the features that we have quantum theory is can be seen as just general features of the geometry of these spaces. So one thing that is really special in the quantum case is the transition probability, and this is sort of kind of logarithmic. And what you do is you take a face of your state space. So in this case, it is just this point here, right? That's a face. And what you do is you take every measurement that gives you probability one for this state. So in this theory, there's only one measurement, right? It's just the one touching that state, right? You can imagine the theory. So this example will come up a bit later. You can have a theory where the state space is something like this, and this is your state. And there are many big functionals that assign probability one to the state. So that whole range there. So what you do is you take all of these functionals and you take the take another arbitrary state and then take the probability of this state in the set of functionals and take the infimum. So this is the picture here. So if this is your initial state, you take all the functionals and assign the probability one. In this case, it's just one. Take any other state, and then take the infimum, which is just one, so there's only one in this case. Okay. And it's this distance here.
I didn't follow that at all. Define the detection ratio. I'm lost. So the
idea
of pure state. You start on the pure state? Is that the idea?
Yes. That's for example.
An extreme point, is that what
you're
doing? You're starting at an extreme. All right, so let me go back a step. So, I mean, you drew a cone up there and you drew an actual cone, but really this doesn't have to be a circle.
It's, no, not at all.
So it's any convex set. You make a cone out of it by having a point down here and you project up.
Yeah.
Okay, so then the extreme points of the convex set, I'm just going to call it pure states.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you start with a pure state then.
Yeah.
And you said, what's this D thing?
This guy up here,
yeah,
is all measurements, all the effects,
yeah,
all functionals, which assign the state probability one.
Okay. So it's all possible measurements for which.
So remember, a measurement is represented by two planes in the space.
Okay.
By two lines. Right?
All right, I think I missed that, but all right.
So that was, okay, so that was back here.
I'm confused by the terminology,
okay,
just a little bit. Maybe that's part of what's confusing me. So measurement doesn't assign a state of probability. One states assign probabilities to measurement algorithms.
Right.
So this is a measurement such that if you have this state S,
yeah,
it gives outcome D of S with probability one.
Yeah.
Is that's what you meant?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're starting with the measurement.
You can go back and forth. So I think,
yeah,
of measurements as functionals on states. I can go the other way. States as functional on measurements. It's completely equivalent.
Okay.
Right. So whatever language you prefer.
I just needed to understand. Okay.
Right.
All right. So that's all measurements such that you get probability one.
Yeah.
For that state.
So if this is a state here, this is supposed to be in the corner here.
Yeah. Okay.
Then this set of functionals is every line that touches that point.
Okay.
It goes like that, all the way up here. Right?
What's the yellow one?
The yellow line, this is the boundary of the state space.
Oh, that's state space. Okay, all right. Okay, so then the detection, all right, so the next step then, because you got to that, right? The infimum,
yeah,
thing? Okay, the detection ratio, what's x?
X is some other arbitrary state. It's better.
All right. So what does the given S0 mean?
Take S0 to be this state.
Yeah.
This is a more general state, but let's just take it. Take S0 to be this state here.
Uh-huh.
X is another state here. So you can think of this as, in quantum case, this is sort of the conditional probability.
Yeah, but what's the given X0? I mean, why isn't this D of X?
Given S0.
Yeah, so it's what's the probability of, what probability does X assign to all the measurements which are one of this one?
Okay. All right.
Okay.
All right. I gotcha.
So, for example, you know, this is prepare spin up along Z axis.
Yeah. Okay.
I take all measurements which go to one.
Yeah. Okay.
And then take spin up along the X axis. This right here.
Mm-hmm.
And then
all those measurements from which you get probability
right.
One on the
yeah,
other.
That's right.
Which ones?
So, which one is the smallest? So, in a sense, you can think of this as the probability of confusing these two states.
Okay.
The best probability.
Sure. Yeah.
The minimal probability of confusing these two states.
Okay, great.
Right. And so, in the quantum case, this is what it is, right? If you take a pure state and any effect such that this is one, then for any other state, this is greater than or equal to the transition probability, the inner product. Right? So, you can sort of see how. The Hilbert space angle is sort of coded in this geometry of specs states. So the linear and circular polarized light is an example of this. If you prepare vertical polarization and you pick a measurement which tells you whether you're in vertical polarization or not, probability one, then if you carry out that measurement on circularly polarized light, then you will get better than half, or it'll be higher than half. Any measurement will be probably higher than that. That's the idea. So this is sort of an impossibility principle if you want to think of that, like coded into the state space. And so it's the geometry of the space tells you what you can do in the lateral sense. So we're sort of going backwards now here. You're given some geometry. What does it tell you about your physical theory? So transition probabilities are usually associated with dynamics, right? Not just prepare a state and measure something. Okay. You have an initial state and you have a final state. Okay. So that's where this idea of focus comes in, which can be thought of as transformations and preparations as well as just measurements. So the idea here is that you take two pure states and then take the set of all filters or transformations which leave these two states alone. They're neutral to them, right? They just let them pass through. Okay. And then you take the state x and send it through this transformation, ay. Okay. So ay tells you with 100% accuracy whether you have state y. And now instead of sending y through it, you send x through it. Okay. And then you calculate the probability of this transformation. Okay. So in the quantum case, this ends up being the transition probability again. But in these more general frameworks. This isn't the case. So what's special about the quantum case is that there's this one-to-one relationship between pure states and these filters, okay, which is going to be very special. So one of the things that can fail in these more general theories is that there may be more than one of these filters. They may not be unique minimal in that info room that I took before, or this symmetry isn't there. So, whoops. So before I go to some examples, I'll just go through these axes. So this sort of direct follows from the example I was talking about a second ago. So the idea behind the first axis is that for every pure state, you have a detector which tells you whether you have that state or not with 100% accuracy. And if you send in any other state, you won't be confused. It'll always be the probability always less than one. Okay. And so this is the state here. So RS tells you whether you're in state S, and the probability is 1 if you carry this measurement on state S. And every other state S prime, it's less than 1. And then the second axiom is this symmetry. So if you have two states, S and S prime, and their respective measurements, you have this symmetry, which is exactly the transition probability symmetry in the quantum case. Right? So The other part of the axiom is that the state space has enough symmetries, right? So if you start out somewhere, you can get to any other point. Okay. So what does that mean? The first thing means is that you can actually prepare this for space in the lab, and you can identify it. Okay. So if you don't have these axioms, then something goes badly wrong with your theory. You don't have a notion of pure states anymore, really. So one way you can think of this symmetry property, for example, is that it's some kind of dynamic process, but it's not really clear if that's the best way to think of it, and maybe this notion of conditional probability is a better way to think of it, in the sense that if you prepare some state, and then you can carry out some measurement, what's the conditional probability? What's the new state afterwards after you create a session, or what's the conditional probability of that state? Right, so it sort of calls an update rule, or a symmetry of the update rule. Yeah.
Can you think also of how that constrains, if you go back to the picture, just with the operational boxes?
Yeah.
Don't Hogg's axioms tell you something about the way in which you could interchange the boxes when you have one set?
That's one way to think of it. You could sort of go back to this dynamical symmetry, right? For every preparation, there's a measurement, right? You can interchange them. There's literally no difference between them. There's no loss anywhere, in a sense, in the sort of the in-principle limit, right? These are the in-principle axioms. So the question is, what if you drop some things? What happens? And so there's this box theory. So this is a space of normalized states, and there's four of them. There's four pure states, sorry. These are the four pure states. So this is the maximum mixed state here. And if we take this pure state here, call it x, then there's a whole range of measurements that tell you whether you're in a state or not. Right? So there's that one over there, right? And it turns out that the one that tells you whether you're actually in a state and not in the other, the one that identifies it, so this measurement here, right? This isn't a pure measurement. It's not an extreme element of the space of measurements, right? So if you think of, if I draw the space of measurements, it looks like a square like this. So it's sort of just a rotated version of the state space. And this measurement here, which tells you whether it masked in or not, corresponds to a point over here. So it's not one of these. And these measurements here, these two, are actually this plane and this plane here. So you sort of have the strange property that the measurements that can be simulated by any other measurements, they can't tell you whether you're in this state or this one. Can't tell you that one or that one. Right? So there's, in a sense, there's no unique transition probability between states. Right? This infimum is zero. So distance, in some sense, this distance is zero between all these pure states.
So just to remind you, built into this structure is that distinct points on this geometry of this complex set always give distinct statistics for some
measurable
element.
Yeah, there's some measurement which distinguishes them. Yeah. So for example, you know, this point here and this point here are distinguished by this measurement, right? It assigns different probability, the probabilities of the distance from this line. So the other example I wanted to do is sort of a non-elliptic theory. So suppose that this is a state space S, something like this. So it's not a nice ellipse. It's sort of caged in somewhere. This theory is quite as bad as the previous one. The only thing that fails for this one is the symmetry of transition. So you can take this state here, and take this state here. So if you take the measurement, which tells you whether you're in the state, you assign some probability to this one, right? This distance. And if you take the measurement, which identifies this state, you assign some probability to this one. And maybe in this picture it looks like they're roughly the same, but if you can come up with shape, they're not.
Just do it in the corner. Right?
Yeah. Instead of this. Yeah, so then the first axiom is satisfied to this theory. It's just the symmetry does. And so it's strictly convex here just means that it has sort of a smooth shape like this. There are no flat pieces, which maybe this looks like, right? That's an important piece. Yes. A little while ago, here's what I mean. There's this information theoretic derivation or axiomatization of quantum theory by Clifton Blue and Halberstam, and they assume a Cesar-Alper framework for their axioms. They represent their axioms in this framework. And it turns out that if you start out with a framework like this, you have nothing like this. You're automatically assuming that you have these symmetric transition probabilities. Okay? And a few other things, actually. Basically, the projection postulate in this series is the same as in the quantum case, right? The update rule, I shouldn't say projection postulate, the update rule is the same. So if you, going back to the axioms, if you actually take these axioms seriously, then this is what you get. There's this theorem which was proved by a few people, I think, back in the 50s, but it was developed really carefully by Otz and Schultz. And the idea is that if you have a state space which satisfies those properties, then it's basically a Jordan-Banach algebra. Right? So Jordan algebra is just an algebra over the real vector space, which has these two properties. So it's you have a product which is commutative, and it's not quite associative. It has this weird property here. And you can define a product like this in the quantum case. So if you take Hilbert space or a C-star algebra, you can build a Jordan algebra out of it. And the product is actually just so A of D equal to E plus EA. It's just the antinomy there. And so in this theorem, it turns out that there's only so many of these things. These guys here. So the self-adjoint matrices of any size, over the reals, the complexes, quaternions, and the 3x3 of Tomionic matrices. And this extra, these are basically, they look like spheres. They're in every dimension, it's a sphere of that. So Sn is just a sphere. That's the state space. Right? So there's sort of some redundancy. So for S, for n equals 2 here, you're back to the quantum case. Right? But for all the other dimensions, they're different. And so it's not quite quantum theory. Right, but all of these spaces have this really strong symmetry property. They're really, really rigid. And if you want to get the quantum case, what you can do is assume something like Lucien does in his axioms, which are rules for combining systems. Right? And it turns out that only the complex case has this nice property that, this sort of local observability property, that if you want to find out the joint state of an entire big system, a composite system, you can look at the pieces. You don't have to do global measurements. Right. Only the complex, only the rigid has that. Yeah. But I sort of want to emphasize a different point, which is this geometry. So, okay, I'm sort of switching topics here a bit, but another nice geometric way to look at quantum state space that's a bit different from these affine functionals and this operational is to think of the complex projective space as a kind of special symplectic manifold which has a Riemannian metric on it. So this was sort of developed by Ashokar for a while ago. I think various people noticed it before, but it's basically, you can think of the pure space of quantum theory for any dimension as basically being a phase space which has a special metric on it. And this metric is actually the beam study metric. So you sort of have these points on the state space, and there's a notion of distinguishability between them, this distance. Right? And one special feature of these spaces is that they have constant curvature, essentially.
What's the time of time?
It's a holomorphic sectional curvature. It's basically, so if you know what sectional curvature is, then the holomorphic piece just means that you're working in a complex space. It's an extra requirement that it has to preserve some extra structure. So you're only taking some planes. That's it. So the Schrödinger equation in this picture basically looks like a kind of restricted Hamiltonian evolution, one which preserves this distance between these points. Right? So it preserves the metric. And unitary maps end up being, so the unitary group is the intersection of the symplectic group with the orthogonal group on these spaces. So if from this point of view, quantum theory kind of, it starts to look a bit like a classical phase-based theory, but I mean, there's reason that doesn't work in the end, right? It's just a part of the tensor product. But the point I want to emphasize here is this geometric question again. So the fact that you have a metric and you have curvature, but it's a very rigid structure again, right? All of these complex projective spaces have this very special curvature property, which is related to the distinguishability. It's sort of an operational property, right? And so it sort of suggests a natural modification. What if you change this curvature, what happens? Or is it even possible to change this curvature without completely breaking the structure, without maybe going back to classical theory or something like that? So I think I already mentioned this information theory axioms of the Boom-Halberstam. So I guess I think I've already basically said all of this. So yeah, why, from this point of view, this geometric point of view, quantum theory starts to look really rigid. Right? So why is this rigid and symmetric? It's not, you have those nice axioms which sort of show you where this rigidity comes from, but it doesn't, it's not that, I'm not sure how to put it. So maybe this is one thing, I want to bring up is what do people think of these axioms, or this question of modifying the theory, or if this way of thinking of it is interesting. So, independent of that, I actually have one other question, which I don't think is known. This is true or not. So is there a theory which has a strictly convex set of states, set of pure states? So something like this, right? Not necessarily a non-elliptical, which satisfies this relationship between the number of parameters that you need to specify a state. So it's like the rank of that big matrix. So in the quantum case, this is just the dimension of the operator space.
And putting the n to
k.
Get a k.
To k.
Okay.
And n is the dimension of the Hilbert space. Right. So in the quantum case, this is n squared. Right. So it's
the projection of the bumpy stick that you're supposed to be looking at.
Yeah, that's right. So I think this is a natural question given these kinds of frameworks. And it's interesting to see if you stick with n squared, you get anything else. Maybe if you drop that symmetry property, you get anything else. That's the question. And I think I've already mentioned these other ideas of how to modify state space, given this geometric picture. So I think that's all I have to do.
So answer questions.
So a few transparencies back, you said to that theorem about where you get, that's this one.
Yeah.
So isn't the case that if you take that those axioms, then necessarily k is a quadratic function of n? I mean, this is a different n, is it? I'm not sure it's the same n, but...
No, so this would be, the n here would be the dimension of the system, the number of distinguishable states.
Okay.
That's the analog. And so the real interesting thing is called not n squared, right? It's
yeah, but it's still quadratic, at least in the quantum case. So
yeah.
So the question is whether you could prove, whether there's axioms that you're going to prove in that theorem are sufficient to make k a quadratic function of n, not higher.
No, so the problem with these other ones is that k isn't even a function of n. They don't satisfy this property, this local observability property. So that's the way you eliminate them.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is, is this sufficient to show that k equals n cubed, for example, is not possible?
No.
No.
Oh, well. Okay, so if you assume those the Hogg axioms,
yeah,
then none of these have k equals n cubed.
So it is. So Hogg
axioms. If there is a k equals n cubed theory,
yeah,
it doesn't satisfy the Hogg axioms.
Okay, so if one was to append the Hogg axioms to to k equals n to the power d, then you would show in fact that k was n squared.
Yeah.
Nothing else is possible.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so there's two steps, right? You take the Hodge axioms, and you get this. This is all you get. And then you impose this local observability, right? K is a function of n.
Yeah.
Right? And then you just have number two.
So I'm a little confused about that. So in Lucien's paper, when he had K and N, you weren't necessarily referring to local measurability in
no,
any way.
Related.
But you're adding something extra, which is local observability, and you're relating that to.
Doesn't, if you assume a local observability, doesn't your relation follow as well from?
Yeah.
So, you can take Lucien's.
But you're saying you take a bit of a stronger assumption, so it implies that it's an assumption.
It seems like it. Yeah, at least I don't remember any discussion. Of course, I've read the paper 5 years or something.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the relationship between. I know Woodruff takes local observability in the old paper, mm-hmm. and he derives this relationship between K and N.
Yeah. I mean, they're closely related.
Yeah.
In any case, it's really just the counting aspect that you're using here.
Yeah.
So it's not sufficient to have. It's not necessary to have all local observability, just the relationship between.
Yeah, that's okay. Sure.
Am I thinking of an old version, or did you just show that you needed k equals n of d, and then you just said, well, let's take the simplest one?
Yeah, in my case, I took the simplest one that was consistent with the other axiom.
Right, but you had other ones that were also consistent with
them. Yeah, that's my question is whether k equals n cubed, for example.
So local observability, or whatever you call it, local distinguishability. What did you say?
Observability.
Local observability would take it down already to n squared, wouldn't it? Is that what you're saying?
If you have this, so if you start with just local observability,
well,
you have n to the r.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
What I'm asking is, it's a question for both of you guys, I think. So, Lucien, in your paper, did you have local observability?
No, but I had an axiom that was pretty much the same.
Oh, okay.
I just had a counting axiom that k is equals ka times kb.
Okay.
Which would always be true if you have local observability.
Yes, yes. Okay. But that didn't bring it down to n squared?
No.
And so then I'm wondering what axiom is here that wasn't in that paper?
So can you go back to the hard axiom?
So I think in your paper, you have something like this, that you have states which identify, so you have measurements which identify states, and then you prove what's essentially that the state space is the same as the space of measurements, they're the same shape, right?
Yeah.
They don't rotate or anything.
Yeah.
But you only do it for the case for n squared.
Yeah, okay, so that definitely works for k equals n squared. Right.
So
you're saying if that proof works for the general k equals n to the power r, then that would immediately work.
Yeah, so I think maybe if you have these properties, I guess this maybe just depends on the order you take these things in. Like if you have n to the power of r, then you impose these. I'm not sure what you get in that case.
Right.
You might actually stick with the quantum case. You might get something a bit more general.
Is this theorem that follows from these axioms, is it difficult to prove? And what kind of mathematics is involved? Are there extra assumptions that come from the mathematics?
I think there's some topological assumptions and things like this. There's a couple of steps. So one thing that you end up having without that symmetry property is sort of the notion of spectral decomposition. So you need some state as a measurement. And you can sort of decompose it into orthogonal pieces. It's linear combination of orthogonal pieces, just like in the quantum case, right? Even without the symmetry property. And then from there, once you assume the symmetry property, you get the Jordan algebra structure. So the symmetry property is sort of related to this commutativity, I think. Right, so you can have some sort of algebra that's based on these structures, these cones, except we won't satisfy these two. And where those axioms come in is restricting these.
Okay. And then there's another theorem that gets you from the Jordan algebra to this set of options.
So I think these are so one extra assumption is this irreducibility. So you can't write it as just a direct product of two other spaces. That's the case here.
So someone would have to investigate those assumptions.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that would mean.
It seems like I talked to Hans Hoverson once, and he laid out all of the niggling details of what has to be added.
Mm-hmm.
And there were things like the state space must be an orientable manifold.
I think there's different ways of proving it.
I'm like, well, what does that mean? Well, it took him quite a while to explain to me what it meant. I've already forgotten it.
I think it's
but
actually,
it didn't
it might
sound
need to
particularly physically motivated in any
yeah,
way.
I'm not totally sure, but I think you don't necessarily have to take.
That's so you with so when you said some topological assumptions, like,
they
seem to be crucial to the whole affair, make it go. At least that was the impression I got from him. So maybe you could drop that one, but do you have to substitute something similarly daunting?
I'm not sure about the topological assumptions, but this orientability and the other, there's a few other things that go along with it. I think they're equivalent. So I think you can start with orientability and a few other things and not have the symmetry property, and then you get the same thing. Or you can start with the symmetry property and forget about orientability and the other things, and you get the same thing. So there's different ways of proving that. Let's say that's an alternate choice. I haven't looked at that too carefully yet.
Question does. So on the next slides, you have that geometric argument, and you say structure evolution is restricted Hamiltonian evolution. What's the restriction there?
Only certain Hamiltonians are allowed. Quadratic Hamiltonians. So if you have a non-quadratic Hamiltonian, you're not preserving this metric. So one way to think of that is you're taking the Hermitian operators and thinking of them as functions on a phase space. You just take their expectation value, and for every Hermitian operator, that function is going to be some sort of quadratic function. Right?
So this means you have linear forces, essentially. So
that's where the linearity illusion comes from. That's the orthogonal part.
But, okay, so this is a Hamiltonian in a totally different space than the normal Hermitian operator on Hilbert space.
So the idea is you take, because
obviously you have, non-quadratic Hamiltonians in quantum mechanics. So
it's not a question of the Hamiltonian being quadratic, it's a question of the reflection on the phase space. So the idea is you think of, so you think of these, the vectors, the complex vectors in the complex projective space as, so you can sort of decompose this into just a giant real vector, right? And you take the expectation value and you get some function of this coordinate. So this is just a function on some manifold. It's a phase space. It's exactly a phase space. It has the same structure. And if you take a Hermitian operator and take this expectation value, this function will always be some kind of quadratic, some product of some sum of quadratic functions. And that's where the linearity comes from. So in a sense, you've got a restricted form of classical theory. If you take a different kind of Hamiltonian on space, you're going to get a different non-linear evolution, right? You won't preserve this distance. So basically, you're restricting your Hamiltonians such that you're preserving your orthogonal group.
So it's quadratic in terms of the vectors and the complex.
On the state space, and it's quadratic.
It's not in terms of its algebra. It's not like a quadratic.
No. Algebra. So I'm not really sure what to make of this argument. It looks like you almost have a classical theory with some restrictions, but then you start taking tensor products and things start to break down. You start getting negativity and things like this, of course. But it's kind of neat that some classical illusions are hidden in there.
Well, did he develop anything along these lines where he looked at non-constant curvature modifications of them?
He had a theorem, I think, that said that that this constant curvature case is sort of the nicest one in the sense that you have the most observables. In non-constant curvature, you sort of lose observables, something like that. But I don't think he looked at specific cases.
Are there any sort of no-go theorems that might apply to something like this? So if suppose you did have one of these theories, you might just... Do you know that you can't signal it?
I have no idea. Yeah, I have no idea what that would do.
Other questions? Well, though this was the first in our ongoing series of Quantum Foundations seminars, we won't have one next week. But in substituting for that, we'll have a whole conference on quantum foundations. The clock and the quantum would last all week long, so I encourage everyone to go to that. And let's thank Cosmo.